And it goes through places like the Valley of Ghosts, Emek Raphaim, for example. And, you know, it was called the Valley of Ghosts back then. What is it 2,000 years later? You could just imagine.
Exactly, yeah. Ghosts are still running in this city, I tell you. Yeah.
And it's also suggested that the dead are enlisted in current wars. And you know, when I think about that image from the book, I think about Lord of the Rings. I don't know if you saw that movie, where they in fact did enlist dead. And so maybe there it's not such a fictional thing, but it's a metaphor. It's like fiction trying to tell us something, that the dead do have a role to play, but not only in wars, but in our own lives in a more mundane way as well.
Exactly, and enlisting the dead, you know, that's a good question. I mean, who's in command, you know? Who's taking the lead, and who's enlisting the dead to his own army? And if you look you look around, you see that different people who see themselves as commanders or generals or whatever, or leaders, and they enlist the dead to their own ideological army.
Right. You asked the question, where does it stop? And before the interview, you mentioned that you have an 18-year-old son and a 16-year-old son. Does it not stop with people like you who begin to teach their children that these ways of dealing with the world are lead to disappointment and sorrow and grief, and that the way is negotiating how to be open without going crazy? Are these the lessons your kids get?
I hope so, you know, I hope so. And I actually think that, I hope I'm successful, but if you think about, you know, if you think about not only about myself, but about Israel as a whole, and about, about the Israeli, I don't know how to say it, about the Israeli public opinion, maybe, yeah. I'm not that sure that we're in a good position here, you know. Seems to me that the tendency right now in Israel is right-winged. That's where we're heading. And the situation in the Middle East is not getting better. It's on the other direction. So maybe, you know, as an individual, I can give my kids my own impressions of reality and my own lessons from reality. At the same time, I'm not optimistic about the future of this place. I'm sorry to say it.
I understand. You know, you mentioned the experience of reality. There, the protagonist, Jonah, at one point in the book is said to experience reality in a different way. Obviously, we're talking about something that goes beyond materialism. I also think about the Charles Olson quote from Projective Verse about what stance toward reality brings such verse into being. So we're hinting at this notion again that life is perhaps 5% material and 95% energetic, and people don't seem to know that.
Well, you know, you read a lot of poetry. It makes a difference. That's a good question. I mean, how many people read how much poetry? Poetry is a great lead, you know. It takes you to other realms. And I'm not sure how many people read the right stuff. Let's put it this way.
I think you're right. I think most of the poetry that gets consumed, and I would use that word specifically, consumed, is that which doesn't seek to be difficult, and or that which seeks to be difficult for the purposes of evasion. So it's a very interesting sort of middle ground that you and I are after in poetry. There's another line that haunts the narrator Jonah in the book, and it is, "Weep me not dead." At the moment of the story, it is said to refer to his loved one, who he's looking for, and "weep me not dead" is, hey, keep hope alive, is a way of interpreting that. But I also am thinking about indigenous culture, like Dogon culture, in which the dead allegedly use the energy expended by survivor grief to move on to the next world. In other words, the dead will hang around here unless we cry enough to push them into the next realm. And it would seem to me that weep me not dead might refer to that. It might refer to the, you know, throngs of ghosts that you have in a city where maybe the impulse was go to more revenge rather than to grief work.
I didn't quite follow your last sentence about the revenge.
So perhaps the emphasis in Jerusalem and in the world in general has been towards revenge rather than simply entrenching oneself in genuine grief so that the dead could be propelled to the next realm and not hang around here and not interfere so much in what's going on.
Yes, exactly. I mean, let the dead, leave the dead behind in a way. Don't forget them, but don't keep them alive. Don't get them a presence in your life of everyday life and stand on your way to the future. Take what is best from the past. Take the memories of the past. Take the good things of the past. And follow your way. Onward to the future. Your previous question was about the army of the dead. That's the same thing. Don't enlist the dead in order to bring the past and keep the past and don't lose yourself from the past and keep going further. There's a battle, there's a battle going on what is our lesson from history and what do we take from history and which parts of history history offers us so much, so what do we take from there? What do we leave behind? What do we take? And I think there's a real battle going on this because part of the, or maybe the majority takes what I believe is not the right stuff from the past.
Right.
Maybe we should take, Jonah is talking in the book about taking, not leaving behind the beauty of the past, but leaving behind the evil and the ideological that sometimes and too often is stuck to the beauty and sometimes people use beauty as a means to serve for ideological purposes.
Yeah, or as you say in the book, the past eats the future bite by bite.
Bite by bite, yes, yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, once again, I'm talking about specifically about the ancient Jerusalem, what we call Old City or the Ancient City. Walking in the Old City of Jerusalem is walking in the past, is walking in or in a reality where past and present is mixed. And sometimes you feel that the past is eating your life. You do feel it,
And that might be, that leads us to another sort of biblical notion that's brought up in the book, that that past, if one lets one lets the past and the ghosts and the entities take over oneself, like perhaps the politicians who start the wars, turns one into a golem, a clay automaton. And the notion here, part of the subtext is we need to resist that in our lives, and it goes back thousands of years. We were warned about it in the Bible, and here again we're reminded of it, but in Jerusalem it's more easy to be reminded of it, and yet in Jerusalem it's more easy to become a golem.
It is. Like Jonah is walking his way on the street, his legs, so to speak, takes him on a tour to David's grave, King David's grave, and inside there, inside this very unpleasant place, I must say, he see two golems because these two men are acting like automats. They're acting like golems. They seem to be mumbling or acting like people whose mind is not in control or lost their mind or whatever, and this is supposedly a very holy and important place, a place where people should come and think about the past, not stand as a golem and you know, and mumbling the phrases from the past, but think what this past means, you know, for us now, in these days, what can we do with it? But once again, material life takes over because it's the grave, you know, it's the stone, it's this thing which is taken in a simple and unsophisticated way, in which a stone takes with it something of people, like these two automats standing near the stone, and they feel that the stone is holy. The stone is, they can't acknowledge themselves as human being near this stone. This shouldn't happen, you know. This man shouldn't lose himself as a human, shouldn't his, acknowledge himself as null, as nothing, when he stands near a holy place.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I took the book to a writing retreat in the islands here in the Northwest. And, you know, I was just committed to, well, you know, when you get the book in the mail from the publisher and with a nice inscription and, you know, from a person whose work has inspired you, you know, you feel responsibility to at least take a look at it. And then when I started reading it, I was really drawn into it and read it very quickly, which is a rare thing for me in fiction, because most fiction I see is junk and I'm not interested in it. Maybe I haven't seen the right kinds, but there was an interesting kind of synchronicity that happened for me, because I'm also reading Ramon Gomez de la Serna, who is a neo-Baroque poet, and he's written these aphorisms, these one-liners. And I came to this one-liner by chance when I was reading your book, and the line was, "Living in one century would be like living in them all if one only knew how to look at stones with serenity."
That's beautiful. That's just beautiful. You should send me a link with to the book. That's beautiful, because I'm not familiar with this author. That's very good.
That's really the key of what's going on, isn't it, Shahar?
Yes, if I knew, you know, I could use it as a motto for the book.
Yeah,
it's very nice.
I think what he's getting to is what we've been getting to. Regarding seeing reality as a little more complex than things. And when we do that, it opens up a lot of possibilities, but it opens up probably millions more questions. And for someone who retains this way of being in the world and who's at work and communicating it in such an artful way and from a place where it's probably most necessary in the world, somewhere in the Middle East, in the hotspot of really the core of what's going on, it's really yeoman's work that you're doing, and I'm very grateful to be connected to you and to be able to have this exchange. My last question is, I got a sense from reading this book that this notion of going on like an automaton and not realizing how the dead affect the present and this kind of thing is really at the core of what's going on in the Middle East, which is really at the core of what happens with the United States and essentially the whole world. I mean, if we can really get to the core of this issue, we can really transcend as a species. Is that being too grandiose, or do you think there's truth in that?
Oh, no, that's I think there's a truth in it. I mean, that's the whole point. I don't know, you know, I wouldn't say about the U.S., because I'm not American, so I wouldn't dare talk about the U.S., but certainly if you talk about the Middle East, the past rules the present. People look at the past and they see the future. I think Jonah says something like that in the book. They look at the past and instead of, you know, realizing that that's over and that's the past and whatever it was, these are, you know, the scriptures or the myth or the legend or words, you know, just words that are left and relics to some or archaeology, you know, archaeological stuff. But these are all remains that we should interpret in certain ways. And once we'll make the change and start looking at the future and not at the past, and leave the past, you know, and take the past only those things which we know will enable us to move forward, not going back to the past. That's the only change that could happen, a real change. I'm completely in agreement with you that the dead is the main issue here, you know, that sticking to the dead instead of sticking to the living, you know.
Right. And yet, as scholars of Whitehead, we must point out his quote, "It is the business of the future to be dangerous."
Well, dangerous is good because, you know, it makes you aware, right? If you're aware of certain possibilities, you move forward. You move cautiously, but you move forward. So it's not totally a bad thing, you know.
Well, it's just an amazing book. It's really thought-provoking, and I could see someone reading this several times, and I can see it existing as a classic that is relevant for hundreds of years to come. Thank you for taking time to talk about it and for writing it in the first place. I'm so grateful. Thanks, Shahar.
Thank you so much, Paul, for this interview. So, thank you so much.